And welcome back to the Rock Chalk Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Mitz. Today, we are doing the first of our preview series of all the football opponents for Kansas football. This is part of our 100-day countdown to what we think is going to be the beginning of the football season. Obviously, COVID-19 might have some other ideas on whether that actually happens or not on time. But to try to get as ready for this as we possibly can, we are taking a look at the football opponents for Kansas, but in reverse order, like we did, actually like we've done the last few years. Starting at the end of the schedule and working our way back to the front so we can do, you know, so we only have to look at those first few games once or that first game once. And so to start us off today, I have Melissa Trebwasser from Frogs of War coming to talk to us about TCU. Melissa, how are you doing today?
You know, that's such a loaded question these days, but I'm healthy and, you know, have a job, so I guess I can't complain.
Yeah, very, very true. I mean, you know, we can potentially talk about all the other stuff that's happening around here, but I know we've done quite a bit of that already here on the podcast, but, you know, I don't want any of that to be off limits, but, you know, we are trying to look ahead and trying to look ahead into the end of November, which can be fairly difficult at this point anyway, in a normal year. Obviously, with COVID-19 really not allowing any kind of spring football, for the most part, you know, except for a few schools that got it in a little bit early, and you know, no summer workouts or anything like that so far. You know, most of the Big 12 is coming back to school soon so that they can go ahead and get that summer workout started. But you know, this is going to be a little bit more difficult, I think, than normal. But based off of where TCU was at the end of last season, and you know, what has come, what is leaving, and kind of all the, you know, the normal off-season, quote-unquote, transaction type stuff. What are you expecting from this TCU team, and where do you think the biggest storylines are going to be for this team?
You know, it's really hard to kind of project ahead coming off of a 5-7 season, having 10 guys get drafted or sign with an NFL club, and then only having 4 spring practices, because when you look at this roster, it was young last year and it's still going to be young in 2020. I think there's a little bit of kind of quiet optimism amongst the fan base, but there's so many more questions than there are answers heading into summer workouts and fall camp and whatever, you know, the season's going to look like. That this should be a bowl team, but I don't know if anybody is willing to like get much more excited than that this year, just because there's just so many unknowns around almost every position group on the roster.
Yeah, I mean, and specifically, you know, TCU is known for their defense. They were a fairly good defensive team last year, and you know, they had some things that were coming along on offense, especially towards the end of the year. But you know, they lost quite a bit defensively. You know, their entire secondary is gone. And like you said, they had a lot of people that were drafted, which usually is good talking about the strength of the program, but also if you're not replenishing it with, you know, top recruitment classes, it's really hard to kind of sustain that, you know, and TCU had enough problems last year as it was. So specifically though, like on defense, I guess that's where we'll start, because that's what TCU is known the most for, is their defense. But with so many guys, do you have any sense of who might be the guy to kind of step in, what the defensive scheme might look like, you know, like where those strengths will be?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, you know, you look at the defensive side of the ball and you think, okay, Jeff Gladney, one of the best cornerbacks in the country, probably the most underrated big-time cornerback in the country. He gets drafted in the second round, and Julius Lewis graduates, but he missed so much of last season with injury. And then Vernon Scott gets drafted, shockingly, in the seventh round. But he's also a guy that missed quite a bit of time due to injury. And TCU's defense was exceptional last year. I think it gets lost when you look at the record. But if you really look at, you know, how inept the offense was, everything that the defense did to cover that, it was one of the, you know, it's probably top two unit in the conference when you look at the statistics, especially the weighted statistics. But the thing that gives me a lot of hope is there are two things, really. And number one, the Frogs generated almost completely negligible pass rush last year. One of the worst teams in the Power 5 teams in the country as far as getting to the quarterback, whether that was sacks or hits or pressure. It's just really terrible. So you're asking your secondary to cover on just a quarterback that has a wide open look at the field. And so hopefully it can't be worse than last year. You've got guys coming back with a year more experience. You brought in some JUCO players. So the chance to generate a stronger pass rush is absolutely there. And that gives you a lot more hope. And then you look at the secondary, you know, you lose three starters that are seniors, but you have two of the most highly rated safeties in the country in Trayvon Moehrig and Ardarius Washington. And so when you look at Moehrig, especially, like, that's a guy who not only is an exceptional player, who's a guy that could go pro after his junior season if he so chose, but he's a natural leader. He's a coach on the field. He has a real intrinsic understanding of the playbook, and he's so natural in that defense. He is the ideal Gary Patterson safety. So I think with him, and then Washington is a ball hawk. He reminds you a little bit of the Honey Badger. He's got a little Tyrann Mathieu in him. You know, he's small, but he plays big. He's speedy. He's instinctive. And he just always is where he needs to be. And he was only a redshirt freshman last fall. So I think with those guys leading, you know, there's some young players, some interesting pieces. You've got Travius Hodges-Tomlinson, who's the nephew of LaDainian Tomlinson at one corner. He got a couple starts last year. Keon Stewart showed promise as a true freshman, but was liable to give up a big play too. But then you also have you know, Donovan Collins is a redshirt freshman. Noah Daniels is back healthy. He looks like a superstar in waiting if he can stay on the field. And then you do have some experience in Tony Wallace. So there are guys that can step in on the outside. They're not going to be as good as Jeff Gladney, but they're not going to be as bad as, you know, worst case scenario either. So and then, of course, at linebacker, Garrett Wallow is a preseason all conference player. And as long as somebody can step up next to him, then I think you're looking at a solid unit from top to bottom, really at all levels, that can maybe not be as consistently strong, but maybe has a chance to make more big plays. And I think that if they can generate a pass rush, then everybody else is going to look better too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really going to come down to how well the pass rush can gel and can actually, you know, make an impact. Because last year, I think what you saw was without that pass rush, they were getting torched repeatedly, because you can only, mm-hmm. you know, no matter how good your defensive secondary is, they can only stop a quarterback from finding a hole for a certain amount of time. Like, it's literally impossible to hold sure. coverage for longer than, you know, 6 or 7 seconds, unless you were completely just, you know, the opposing receivers are just completely inept at what they do. And so, you know, there was a lot of times, and you know, from watching TCU, there was a lot of times where I saw that the pass rush just never got home. And so people could just hang back there forever and wait and finally find someone. And that led to a lot of really lopsided scores or yeah. a lot of, you know, lopsided performances by the defense. You know, and I think the most frustrating of those was against SMU. You know,
yeah. Just, yeah.
And so, like, I think that was kind of the perfect example where if you flip it around, and maybe the secondary isn't as strong, like you're saying, but the pass rush is good. If they can get that to work, they definitely are going to be a much stronger team defensively. Now, on the, you know, contrasting with that, what about on the offense? Because Max Duggan seemed to get a little bit better as the season went on, but he still had very significant problems. You know, they are losing quite a bit in terms of, you know, there's no Jalen Reagor anymore. They've got all kinds of issues in terms of, you know, star player or not star players, but some of their contributors throughout the backfield in their skill positions aren't really there. Do they have guys that are ready to step up? And, you know, are there any particular people that you're either worried about that are projected to be starters, or guys you're really excited about that most people have no clue who's actually coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Duggan obviously is the biggest question mark here. And I think what we saw from him as a true freshman was that he was a gamer and he was asked to do things that were not a part of his skill set as an 18-year-old quarterback. He wasn't very accurate, but when he had time to set his feet, like, you can see that he's capable of making every throw on the field. I mean, he was put dimes downfield and receivers were dropping them like crazy. I mean, TC's drops the last 2 years have just been just insane, the level of bad wide receiver play that they've gotten. I mean, even Reagor had a ton of drops last year, and maybe part of that was just kind of being like, this sucks and I'm out. But There, if the wide receiver play improves even slightly, Max Duggan looks like a completely different quarterback, even last year as a true freshman. To me, his development is going to come down to a couple things. Number one, like I said, the wide receivers have to just catch the damn ball. Like, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Like, when it is on target, I think back, you mentioned the SMU game, there was a absolutely beautiful ball put in the corner of the end zone. Happened in the Baylor game, too. Just a perfectly catchable, wide open, just placed perfectly and just dropped. Just completely and totally dropped in the end zone. You know, both of those, you make both of those catches in both of those games, and they likely become TCU wins. And that was kind of the story. The TCU was always one play away, just one play away. There's a lot of one-score games, not a whole lot of lopsided results. I mean, even against Oklahoma and Norman, they were literally one stop away from having a chance to go down the field and win. So you hope that some of those laws of averages kind of catch up to you this year, and you get a few more breaks, but a lot of that just starts with the individual play on the field. So the wide receivers have to catch the ball. Without Jalen Reagor, you're looking at Tay Barber, who was hurt a lot last year. He has superstar potential. DeVaylon Hunt is a guy who looks the part and should be really strong going into now his third year with the program. And then, of course, the signing of Quentin Johnston, who was a Texas he was committed to Texas. The Frogs swooped in at the very last moment and stole him away. He certainly should be a really, really strong player, even as a true freshman, a four-star talent. And then you get Dylan Thomas back, too, as a redshirt senior who feels like he's been in the program forever. So maybe the play improves slightly. The other issue with Duggan was the offensive line. Offensive line was just really hot garbage, which is amazing when you look at, you know, you sent two or three guys to the NFL. That has to be a lot better. When Lucas Niang was on the field, which his last game was the Texas game, the offensive line was the amount of hits and sacks and, you know, the time before a running back was tackled or touched was completely different than when he wasn't on the field. And so you're replacing a lot of pieces, but it's one of those instances where you're like, man, we're losing a lot of seniors from the offensive line. But outside of Owagwu and Yang, none of them were very good. So maybe it's an addition by subtraction moment. Quinn McMillan is a more than serviceable center. He's a pretty good player. And I think that with some transfers like TJ Stormett out of Colorado State, some other pieces, the offensive line should be improved. And then the play calling. You know, play calling is a big part of that. If from the rumors that we're hearing, Doug Meacham is going to be much more involved in the play calling than we were initially led to believe, that Sonny Cumbie is going to have a lot more voices in the room. Jerry Kill is there as kind of the fix-it guy. And so you would think by default that this is going to be a system that's much more geared towards Duggan's skill set and it's going to give him a much better chance of being successful. So all three of those factors come into it. And then you add in the running backs. You lose Shaywo, you lose Darius, neither of whom I think were used very well the last couple of years anyways. But you add in Zach Evans, the first five-star ever to sign with TCU in the era of stars. You know, he's got some question marks. There's some concerns about, you know, what kind of player he's going to be. He's shown some immaturity throughout his high school years. That's why he was available to TCU to sign in May. But he certainly has the talent to be an absolute superstar in the Big 12. And then the one that I'm most excited about is Darwin Barlow. He redshirted last year. He's the kind of guy that you watch him in practice and you knew he wasn't quite ready to be a primetime player, but you watch him in practice, you hear the coaches talk about him, and it seems like that he could be somebody that bursts onto the scene that everyone had forgotten about and becomes an impact player. So, you know, I think we'll be fine at the running back position. TCU has two great tight ends, so if they ever learn how to use one on offense, which I've never really seen done effectively in my 20 years following the Frogs, then the talent is there. Will it all come together? Like, that's the question. And if TCU's offense can just be slightly better than competent by Big 12 standards, the defense should be pretty strong and you should be a lot more competitive as a program in 2020.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you actually kind of hit on every single point that I was about to follow up with, but I do actually have a couple follow-up questions. But before I do that, I'm going to go ahead and throw it to our first break. We'll be right back on the Rock Talk Podcast. And we're back. All right. So to kind of piggyback off of what you were talking about before, because what I was hearing a lot and kind of the general, I guess, feeling that I got from talking with some TCU fans was that there was a lot of people that were upset with either how the offense was run and how it was put together, And there was also people that were just as upset and tried to put as much of the blame on Max Duggan and his actual performance. And so I guess my first question is how much of the struggles last year do you think were due to Max Duggan's decision-making and he needs to improve on, and how much of it was offensive scheming and the offensive staff not utilizing the guys that they had correctly?
I think so. I think there's a couple things. I think that a lot of times that we see these highly rated Elite 11 quarterbacks show up at the Power Five, and we expect them to be able to step on the field right away and be superstars. And TCU is not at the level recruiting-wise to recruit Trevor Lawrence, you know, the Tua Tagovailoa. Like, the guys that can step on the field, you know, if I just, like, totally slurred through his name and just wasn't even going to worry about it. they're not recruiting the kind of guys that can step on the field and from day one be an all-conference player. Like, that's not Max Duggan. You know, the expectations for him, we got ourselves in a really bad situation because you went from Trayvon Boykin to Kenny Hill, and Kenny was never treated fairly by the fans. He was a much better player than he was given credit for. And then from you expected Sean Robinson to be the heir apparent, and Sean Robinson quit on TCU and left and is at Mizzou now. Good for him. Hope he does well. And then Justin Rogers was supposed to be that five-star superstar, step on the field as a true freshman and be great. And he had the talent to do it. And he blows his knee completely out the second game of his senior year of high school. And he's never the same. And he's now moved on to, I think, UNLV. So TCU went from having a crowded quarterback room with two guys that had high expectations and could have been 4-year, 3-year starters, potentially like all conference level quarterbacks, to having absolutely no one healthy last spring, except for an early enrollee, two freshmen. And expecting Max to step onto that field and to deal with, you know, love Jet Anderson, but he's got a little ego. Shewu's got a little bit of an ego. Jalen Rager definitely has a little bit of an ego. And to try to appease these junior and senior players that were thinking about their professional futures as an 18-year-old kid, like, I just remember I went up to the Purdue game, and I remember seeing him behind the offensive line and just thinking about how small he looked. You know, like, how much of a high school kid he still looked like compared to everybody else on the field. So when he was at his best was when he was asked to make a quick decision. Like, I don't know why we kept trying to run just streaks with Jalen Rager. That was just fly routes and streaks. It's stupid. He doesn't have the time to sit back in the pocket with that offensive line. And when he was allowed to use his feet, like, he's an improviser, he's a scrambler, he throws beautiful passes, but you need him to be able to get one or two reads deep and let it go, especially as a freshman. So I think Cumbie deserves a lot of the blame, and I fully expect Max to be better with a full year of playing at that level, and with an off season, even though he hasn't been working with the team, he's been working out, he's been throwing with coaches. He should improve. The question was, will Meacham, Cumbie, and Kill give him an opportunity to be a square peg in a square hole instead of a square peg in a round hole like he was last year?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think part of what you talked about there is I'm curious kind of how well that's going to work with having three big voices in that offensive room, because I think everybody was under the impression that Cumbie was going to get fired after the end of last season, and Patterson decided to stick with him. I'm not really sure why. I think a lot of TCU fans probably aren't sure why either. But bringing back Doug Meacham, you know, who obviously that's now the Kansas connection there. But then also, you know, bringing in Kill, like, it sounds like every single one of those three people is expected to have some large impact on what is actually going to be happening with the offense. Is there the danger there of not having a clear direction, trying to throw too many different things together, and it being a jumbled mess come game day?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. That's 100% a risk. And there's a reason that the Cumbie Meacham duo broke up, and it was egos in the room. And, you know, I think that they had a chance to keep Curtis Looper and give him more responsibility. And he's a great recruiter, and he is an outstanding coach. And I don't think there's a TCU fan in the world that would have been unhappy if he had taken over play calling last year. But instead, they decided to let Luke got a chance to be the offensive coordinator at Mizzou. He's there, and so that kind of changed a little bit of the dynamics in the room too. Luke is a really confident, a guy that's been around the block enough and who wanted a chance to have more ownership. And I think that was part of the conflict. Is that Patterson kept choosing Cumbie over him. And I think Patterson still believes in Sonny Cumbie, but I think what he realized is he was not ready to be the guy when Meacham left. And so, and reuniting everybody, they're all on the same page of that The reason, like, everybody was on board with Beachum coming back. Like, those were conversations that Patterson had with Till coming in. Those were conversations that he said, this is what's happening. I need to know that you're okay with it. And I don't know that it was a ask as much of a tell, but it from all accounts, it seems like Cumbie realizes this isn't working out for me. I went from being one of the hottest OC prospects in the country to a guy that no one will touch with a 10-foot pole. And I think Patterson said, I'm going to give you a year to get it together, but you're going to need to defer to these guys that have done it better than you. So from what we understand in the hierarchy, Till is in charge of the offense. He is the coach of the offense. He is the boss of the offense. Everything goes through him. And Meacham is there to help shape the playbook, potentially to call plays, like I mentioned earlier, and to get Sonny Cumbie kind of back on track. And so in theory, you have the different skill sets that could build a really successful offense. In practice, you have three people who have all been at a high level, who all want to be the rooster in the hen house, and it can get real messy really quickly. And them working together is going to be the difference between TCU going to a bowl game or having another, you know, 4-win or 5-win season in 2020.
Yeah, it's just weird because the way you described it basically makes it sound like they kept Sonny Cumbie on as an offensive coordinator in name only. That, you know, if Meacham's going to have play calling or a good portion of the play calling, and Kill is essentially the head guy for the offense, like, it almost seems like Cumbie is there only because, you know, they were too afraid to fire him or didn't feel like firing him. And so it does make me wonder, like, what is he actually bringing to this offense then at this point?
So his skill set, and when when TCU was really, really offensively strong, which was 2014, 2015 and into 2016 kind of had some offensive issues, but mostly injury related. But those 3 years, what works well is that Sonny Cumbie is an outstanding recruiter, just an outstanding recruiter. Like, we've had trouble keeping quarterbacks at TCU, but we've had no problem finding them. And all of them have been really, really talented since he came on board. So he's a great recruiter. Also, he's a great quarterback coach. He's an outstanding quarterback coach. The problem is that he was taking on all of these things and trying to do all of this, and it was too much for him. And so I think he got a little bit in his head. I think that he felt more like he needed to do, and I think too the big shadow and pressure applied by Gary Patterson didn't help him either. So you know, Patterson wants to win with defense, and even like in 2014, 2015, he kind of let that go a little bit, and he allowed the teams to play fast and to use their talent. But when Meacham left, I don't think he trusted Cumbie nearly as much. And so he wanted to slow things down. He wanted to go to an offense that Sonny Cumbie wasn't comfortable probably calling. I don't know if it was what was working for the players or not, but it just there was not a connection there. And so now I think you put Cumbie in a role he's more comfortable with. That, you know, you let him work with the quarterbacks, you let him do recruiting. And in my mind, what I think is going to happen is that Cumbie and Meacham are going to be working together as like a duo, like they have been. When push comes to shove, it'll be interesting to see which guy's on the field, you know, like who's going to be actually calling the plays in the moment. But Kill's not going to be on the sidelines during game day. Like, he's not allowed to, I don't think, it's whatever the new coaching rules are. He's going to be the guy from Monday through Friday or Sunday through Friday that's going to be meeting with the coaches and helping them construct and figuring out what's working and watching practice and analyzing players. And then on game day, it's going to be up to Cumbie and Meacham to find that magic that they had together in 2014 and 2015. I don't know if it exists anymore, but I mean, honestly, like, even if it's kind of a disaster, at least it'll be a fun disaster as opposed to the last 2 years of just watching the Frogs be completely, totally inept on that side of the field after watching, you know, 2.5, 3 seasons of really, really outstanding fun offense.
Well, I mean, as long as the disaster is, you know, it's on the field disaster as opposed to off the field disaster that then leads to the on the field disaster. But I mean, it just, it seems like from the way you're describing it, it seems like Sonny Cumbie has essentially been demoted to quarterback coach, but left with the offensive coordinator title because Doug Meacham is an offensive assistant. Kill is a special assistant to the head coach. It also makes you wonder, you know, Kansas has been in the news recently because of, you know, the whole too many assistants and giving coaching when they're not supposed to and that sort of stuff. And, you know, you have to think that somebody is getting pushed out, probably one of the lower guys there. But, you know, if you have a guy who is not, his title isn't quarterback coach, that's acting as just the quarterback's coach with a little bit of extra, you know, input, it just makes me wonder. It almost, it almost seems like it's just, it's not that Gary Patterson is necessarily setting up, you know, the most efficient and the best way that his offense could work. It's that he's too afraid to fire someone and that he's being too loyal to guy. And I mean, I don't know if that's a criticism or not, but it's that's the way that it reads to an outsider, I think.
Sure. And I think that there have been a lot of people that have been concerned, I guess, about Patterson's loyalty because, you know, he's held on to coaches for decades, literally, that we've kind of been like, why is this person doing this now? And even in the restructuring this offseason, like there was a room to go and to bring in, you know, young, innovative, you know, names that were on the verge of being superstars. And Patterson decided to go with some retreads and then bring in Brian Applewhite from Colorado State to do running backs on that side of the ball. And so, but I think that he's at the twilight of his career. Patterson's not going to coach probably even another 5 years, you know? And so his contract runs out, I think, in 2024. And I wouldn't be surprised if he walked away before then. I don't anticipate him finding an extension at this point. Like, I think he's ready to be done, but he refuses to leave TCU in a worse place than he found it. Even though that's impossible because we were 1-10. I think that what he's looking for is stability and commitment and an opportunity to get things on the right track without having to replace these guys every year for the next 4 years or until his TCU football career is over. I think he also believes in Sonny Cumbie. Like the one thing there was frustration, you know, that I have never in all of my years being around TCU seen him send a coordinator to the podium after a game. And he did that with Sonny Cumbie after the SMU game. And that was very much you want to be a head coach. This is the kind of question. These are the kind of questions you have to answer. Go do it yourself. And that was kind of a check moment. But I also think he believes that Sonny Cumbie is a great human being, which he is. That he absolutely loves TCU, which he does. That he wants what's best for this program. And I think this was his way of saying, I still believe in you and believe you can be good at this, but I'm not. But you need to take a step back and do some learning first. And so he can be overly loyal, absolutely. But you know, like it's really hard to argue against his track record for the last 20 plus years of being involved at TCU and to say he shouldn't be doing this way because it's worked for him for a really, really long time. And, you know, this is only the third or fourth time in 20 something years that TCU hasn't made a bowl game. So I think that 2019 was obviously a step back. It was a negative, but when you look going forward, if you see TCU start to build in the right direction, nobody will care that he was loyal to Sonny Cumbie. You know, nobody will question that. But this is the year where we have to see real positive change and see the Frogs start getting back to being competitive in the Big 12.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, I do want to go ahead and turn it to the schedule. We won't have time to go through the entire schedule, but that and then specifically the game against Kansas that's coming at the end of the year. But before we do that, I need to throw it to another quick break. We'll be right back on the Rock Talk podcast. And we're back. So now that we've we dove a lot deeper into TCU than I think the average Kansas fan really cares about. But I think there's a lot of interesting information that will kind of inform how Kansas versus TCU will end up. Now, it is a little strange that it's at the end of the season. And so very well, like a lot of, I think the thoughtful analysis could be overridden by, you know, if Kansas is 1-10 at that point and TCU is pushing for, you know, one of the top spots, like for the Big 12 championship game, like I don't think that that's really going to have any meaningful, like the game won't matter at all because at that point, I really doubt that Kansas is going to be able to pull off an upset. But based off, so before we get to the actual game, talking about TCU, what are the expectations for TCU this year? Like, I know you said that they're planning on potentially pushing for a bowl game, but that's like the limit of their expectations. Do you think it's going to be a lot like last year where they're kind of up and down all year long? And, you know, the last couple games are really going to figure out whether they can actually go to a bowl or not. Or do you think that there's, you know, like a stretch in there that they can get a bunch of wins fairly early and it's going to be fairly secure at that point?
Well, the thing about the TCU schedule is that it sucks. The Frogs get a bye week 3 and that's the end of their bye weeks. So they play the entire Big 12 schedule without a break, which is an absolutely, utterly insane thing for them to have to do. The 10 straight league games, no bye week. So I think the biggest factor here is going to be the health of the team. How worn down are they by the time they finish with, Iowa State at Texas, Texas Tech and Kansas, you know, like in Oklahoma right before that. But there are no favors done here. You know, I know there's a lot of questions with the Pac-12, but opening up at Cal, if that game happens, then that's, you know, Cal is a program on the rise for sure. I think there's a good chance that the Pac-12 plays only conference games, which means that TCU then shifts to potentially playing Alabama at Jerry World week one. Neither of those are particularly appealing, but I guess I'd rather lose to Alabama than Cal. From there, you've got Prairie View. That should obviously be a win. And then you go at SMU. I think that's a revenge game, and I think Shane Buechele's a really, really good quarterback, but the Ponies lost a lot, and so I wouldn't be surprised if TCU pulls off the win there. But when you look at the way the rest of the schedule lays out, I mean, you've got to go to West Virginia, you've got to go to Baylor, to Texas, to Kansas. You know, if you win two of those games, then you're potentially looking at an 8-win season. You know, if you go 1-3 or, God forbid, 0-4 on the road, then now you're looking at maybe trying to get to 6 wins. So I think Oklahoma State is obviously a contender for the Big 12 championship. I think West Virginia is probably a winnable game. It's really a matter of, you're going to have to win games against the cream of the crop, which I don't know what Baylor's going to look like this fall, but Oklahoma is still going to be good. Texas is, it should be pretty strong. Iowa State should be really competitive and strong. So I hope that TCU is like, I guess I'm kind of in a catch 22 by the time we get to Kansas. Like, there's part of me that hopes that they're playing for something, but there's also part of me that hopes that they're not, because I really hope we're not playing to get bowl eligible, you know, in week 13 of the college football season. And I could see that being a possibility. I'm hopeful that we're looking at, you know, 7-8 wins in a bowl game this fall for the Frogs, and building towards what most people believe could be a really strong 2021 season. But I just,
yeah,
I think finishing at Lawrence.
Right. Like, looking through the schedule, you almost hope that they can have 5 wins after the Texas game, because then they only have to beat either Texas Tech or Kansas. And you have to, you know, like, I think going into that, barring one of those two teams just being, you know, 10 times better than anyone expects, like, I think you give an 80% chance of either winning at home against Texas Tech, you know, or winning at Kansas, like, at least
80%. Also, we own Texas. We own Texas. We've owned Texas. We were bad last year, and we crushed Texas.
Oh, so, yeah. I think Texas is going to fall spectacularly. I've actually already called on the – I was on the 10-12 podcast, and I already called that Kansas is going to beat Texas this year. So, you know, I already called my shot there. I think that Texas is going to have a rough season, that Tom Herman's going to end up getting fired, and that Sam Ellinger is going to go out on a very sour note. And it's not going to be his fault at all, because honestly, I think that coaching staff is going to collapse around him, and Texas is going to have all kinds of problems this year. I agree with you that Oklahoma State is a very, very strong contender. And so, like you were saying, like, it's a really rough beginning of the schedule, you know, because West Virginia, I think, is going to be better than a lot of people give them credit for, you know. And while they faded a little bit at the end of the year last year, they also had some difficult games last year to kind of end the season. And they had to deal with all kinds of issues. I think another year of Neil Brown there is going to help them a lot. But the question is going to be, how high are they going to start? But that stretch of Oklahoma and Iowa State and potentially Baylor, unless they completely fall off, like, I could see that, you know, those first 6 games being a really rough stretch, with only maybe one of those games being, you know, fairly. I guess not really a shoe-in as winnable, but as, you know, ones that you would feel confident that TCU would win.
Sorry, the garbage men are here, my dog.
But since everyone's been working at home, my dog likes to jump on my lap during meetings, like when I'm doing like video meetings with the rest of my team. So since we started working at home, I think my team at work knows my dog about as well as me. So
My dog liked to turn off my power strip while I was in Zoom meetings with my students and kick me out of the meeting. That was always a fun one too. And then you have to like get the kids to let you back in, which is a 50-50 proposition at best. So I've got good kids, so it's fun. But yeah, I mean, I think really the defining moment for TCU this year is going to be at Baylor, Oklahoma, Iowa State, at Texas. And if you win 2 of those 4 games, you know, then you're looking at, you know, 7-8 wins probably on the season. If you go 1-3, then yeah, you're probably playing for bowl eligibility between Texas Tech and Kansas. And if you somehow win 3 of 4, then maybe you're playing for a spot in the Big 12 championship in that final game at Lawrence. So, you know, it's going, there's so many unknowns, obviously, heading into this season. And there's so many things that we don't know what it's going to look like, as far as what game day is going to look like, what between games are going to look like. And so, I hope that what we get out of this year for the Horned Frogs is development, is promise, is seeing the pieces coming together. Because you don't graduate a whole lot of key pieces after 2020 for TCU. You have a couple of guys that could elect to leave early, but you really don't have a ton. You only have a couple of really like starting level seniors on this team. So assuming you don't get, you know, you don't have a lot of guys leave early for the draft, and assuming that the transfer portal doesn't come and suck up all your good players, then you're looking at potentially building towards a 2021 campaign where TCU will legitimately have a goal of going to the Big 12 title game that year. So this season is going to be about getting those young guys experience, making sure that you continue to develop the defense, and then hopefully getting Max Duggan the confidence to be, you know, an all-conference level quarterback in 2021. And that's why this is such a, in so many ways, we are in, you know, college football purgatory, you know, just really across the country. But I think TCU fans are going to feel like that too. We still don't know who this team is. We know on paper what they're capable of being. And hopefully we see in 2020 then start to reach towards what ultimately they can be as a program.
Yeah, so talking specifically about this Kansas game, obviously last year's game you can't really use as any indication because TCU beat them so soundly, but Kansas was dealing with a lot of issues, you know, going back to the really horrible style that you know that they had done prior to the BC game. You know, Khalil Herbert leaving the team immediately, like hours before, you know, they actually were supposed to kick off. There was a lot of extenuating circumstances. So even if, you know, even if you weren't taking into account any of the changes, like you would expect this next game to be a whole lot better for Kansas. One, because it's at the end of the season, but also you're not going to be dealing with a lot of that similar type of stuff, barring, you know, horrible injuries for somebody. And so, but if you're looking at this game from obviously the lens of being several months before it actually happens, like right now, if you had to like sell this game as why someone would want to watch it or things that they might want to be worried about for this game, what is it about Kansas that worries you, or what is it about this game that particularly?
Well, I think that the biggest thing that makes Kansas something to watch is Les Miles is still the coach there. And I think that you're going, you know, he's going to have some time in the program. He's going to have gotten more of his types of players there, recruiting at a much higher level than Kansas was doing prior to his arrival. And so when you think about being the last game of the season, Kansas could be, you know, like you said earlier, 1-10 heading into the final week of the season, or they could, I mean, legitimately potentially be playing for a bowl bid. You know, if they could get to 5 wins if they can win the games they need to win. So I think that is going to be an intriguing thing. I think that getting, you know, an offensive coach like Les Miles, anytime that Gary Patterson lines up against a guy who's known for producing offenses at a high level, that's always a fun chess match because, you know, he loves that challenge. And I think too, like, you know, you're building towards having like finally in Kansas a competent program again. And so you would hope that by the end of next season, that you're starting to see glimpses of the identity of this team and the identity of the program and what type of offense and defense they want to run as opposed to just having to work with what they have. And so, and I think for one of these teams, there's going to be something on the line, you know, whether it's a chance to get a bowl bid or whether it's a chance for something more than that. Maybe there's a player who's looking to, you know, to break a record or something, but you're going to have something on the line that makes this an intriguing matchup. And, you know, I hate to say it, but outside of two games that I can think of since TCU joined the Big 12, the Kansas games have been weird. You know, like that's always, that Kansas TCU game is always something entertaining and odd, and something weird always happens, whether it's a butt fumble or, you know, a kick return touchdown or punt return touchdown that breaks things open. These are not, they've only been blowouts twice, really. Everything else tends to be a 1 or 2 score game. So you know that something weird is going to happen. It's going to be December. There could be snow. Like, God only knows what the football gods are going to do to these two teams come the end of the season.
Yeah, I also think it's going to be a little weird just because, I mean, Brent Dierman will have plenty of time to make his stamp on this program to really kind of reshape the offense. And having an entire offseason, even if it's just planning meetings and, you know, talking with guys, running them through schemes, they're going to be able to do a whole lot more even in this weird offseason than they were able to do in the, you know, over the bye week when they gave him control of the offense last year. You saw what he did and how they were easily able to really change the identity of this Kansas offense. And so, you know, talking about offenses, like, you really have no idea what Kansas is going to bring. And a lot of that's going to depend on who the running back is. I'm sorry, who the quarterback is and what they can do with him. So it'll definitely be interesting to see what they can do. But, you know, I'm excited for this game. One, because like you said, they're always weird games. Kansas seems to always have an opportunity to win that. But I also just think that this is going to be potentially something, you know, that they can go ahead and actually really kind of go ahead and pull all of that from it. And it should be entertaining. You know, also, if you think about it, this is you know, Puka Williams is going to be a junior. This could potentially be his last season, yeah. You know, as the running back for Kansas. And so it'll be interesting to see what he can do.
He hasn't graduated
and what
yet. Can you get rid of him? I would rather not play him again. I just need him to go away. He should go pro early. Like, give him an exemption or something. I'm done with
it. That's a really good year. It could be the last time you see him. So.
Ah, thank God.
And we'll go ahead and leave it on that note. Melissa, thank you for joining me. Where can everybody find your work online?
You can follow me at TheCoachMelissa on Twitter, and you can check out my writing and many other talented TCU-centric writers on www.frogsofwar.com.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you guys so much for listening. Go out for being Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, any of the other million apps that are out there. You can subscribe to us there. Just search for Rock Chalk Talk. You can give us a rating and a review, 5 stars, nice comments. I'd absolutely love it. If not, just let us know what it is we can be doing better. We really do bring this podcast to you guys to get you all the information that you would need in as entertaining a way as possible. So if you ever have any comments, questions, suggestions, people you want to try to interview, topics you want to cover, anything like that, you can email me at rockchalkpodcast@gmail.com. You can contact me on Twitter at rockchalkpod. But again, Melissa, thank you for joining me. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will catch you guys next time on the Rock Chalk Podcast.